Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
And now I'd like to introduce Brian, who's going to speak for the next 10 minutes about his experience, strength, and hope.
I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brian.
I forgot they record this damn thing. This is fucking uncomfortable. I'm going to stay seated. That's just weird to me. Stand up. There's no podium. Oh, fuck everyone. All right. Anyway, so I said I'm Brian, I'm an alcoholic. If you didn't hear that, sorry. Yeah, this is super uncomfortable just having however many people this is just fucking stare at you. I'm just thinking, like, I remember when I first came to AA and I heard people say I felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I'm like, that's some shit you don't really hear people say outside of AA, but I really related to that when I was new. And like, I still feel that way a lot. But I just remember, like, when I was a kid, like, growing up, just totally feeling that way. Another thing people say is, like, everyone else had, like, the instruction manual to life, and I didn't. Like, I don't know. I just looked at everyone around me, and I just felt so uncomfortable, and I was just like, how are you doing all this? Like, how are you just, like, going to eighth grade? Like, I don't get it. So, like, when I first found, like, drugs and alcohol, it was, like, so awesome because it just turned the volume down on everything. Like, I was okay. Like, I totally felt like, you know, I arrived or whatever. And, like, basically just, like, right from the start, I was just down for whatever. Like, I don't know. I never really had any reservations about, like, using. Like, I never said, like, I'll never do needle drugs or anything like that. I don't know. I remember being, like, 16, like, thinking, like, I really wanted to try, like, shooting up, because it just, like, sounded cool to me. And, like, I totally did that, and I'm really grateful for drugs, because they ruin your life in a very, like, really heavy, like, direct way. It's not very, like, subtle. So, like, by the time I was 19, like, my shit was, like, super fucked up. I was just, like, been strung out on heroin for a couple years, dropped out of high school, I don't know, I just wanted to be Scarface, basically, was, like, my aspirations, and I don't know what happened, really. I just remember, like, I'll never forget this, like, one day, I just, like, picked up, like, a piece of foil to, like, get high, and, like, I just didn't want to do it at all. Like, no part of me wanted to do it, but, like, I just had to, and, like, I just had, like, the moment of clarity they talk about. And, I mean, I kept using for a while. But, like, that was the first time where I just truly felt, like, super powerless. And my life was unmanageable. And I hit up my mom. And she, like, found a rehab for me to go to. Because I was, like, a kid. And so they shipped me off to rehab. And I kind of just, like, woke up in this rehab. And I didn't really remember how I got there. Because, like, I had this, like, giant stash of drugs that I just ate all of it before I got on the plane. And then they gave me more drugs, like a medical-type detox. So I kind of woke up several days into a detox, just really confused. And I was, like, super bummed out that I was in rehab. I just, like, I remember I really wanted to leave and just, like, go get high again. But fortunately, like, I lived in Denver, and I was in Los Angeles, so I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any money, so I was just like, well, I guess I'm here. And I just kind of gave AA a shot. I don't know. It's hard to really tell you what I did. I mean, I did the same thing everyone else does, I guess. It's really, I just got a sponsor, and I think most importantly, I just became part of AA, like, it wasn't like, you know, I did 16 10 steps every day and, like, wrote 3 inventories a week. or anything like that. I just became part of AA, went to meetings, like talked to people, and just like was a sober person. And like, I don't know, my life is so different now. Like I went to, like 6 months sober, I went to community college because my mom said she'd give me money if I did that. So I enrolled, and then like a couple years later, I got into UCLA, and then I graduated there, and like then I moved up here to go to graduate school at Cal, and like I have no idea how I got here, but like that's what my life is today. Like today, like I don't know, I go to this like really good school, and on the outside, I'm this like really together person, but I don't know. It's like a quiet storm underneath, like I still feel fairly psychotic most of the time. But it's like super manageable and like, I don't know. I've learned, like AA has helped me a lot. Just like manage that, like all that crazy shit. Like you know, when you're driving and you could just like, want to like do this and all the people on the sidewalk, like, like I can, I don't know. I can think decisions like that through. And, yeah, I don't know. So if you're new, just like fucking hang out and have some coffee and like don't worry about doing it perfectly. And like if you even have the right sponsor, like if you're doing step work right or like what the seventh step means to you or like any of that shit, like just, I don't know, just like hang out and just like don't drink for a while. And, you know, everything can change. Thanks.
All right, and now the main event.
That happened fast. Hi, family. My name is Lache, and I am an alcoholic.
Hello. Hi.
Thank you, Brian. And Elena hit me up and asked me to speak and earlier this week. And I was like, yeah, sure. She said, can you speak for me, Sandra? I was like, yeah, sure. She goes, okay, good. It's the double speaker. And I was like, oh, okay, 10-minute speaker, because they have to have the 40-minute speaker in advance. And she's like, oh, good, you can be my 40-minute speaker. And then she told me you guys were supposed to be watching the fight, so I was only planning on, like, 10 of you being here. But welcome to all the newcomers. And I have a sobriety date. It's June 25th, 2005. So I will be 45 and 10 years sober in June. June 11th is my 45th birthday. And I say that because I struggle with that a lot. Because as an alcoholic, I don't know if it's as an alcoholic or as anyone getting older, I coulda, shoulda, woulda, why didn't I? That kind of shit, right? But my sponsor always would say when I first got sober, everything is necessary. Not just when I got sober, but, you know, throughout my life, everything is necessary. And the longer that I stay sober, hindsight is 20/20, right? And I go, oh, okay, that's why. I will jump all over the place, but I pinky promise it all comes together and it does make sense. I'm going to try to talk slow because I get super excited and then I talk super fast, but I have 40 minutes to fill. So I have a sobriety date. I have a sponsor. And I've had my sponsor since I first got sober. That works for me. It has taught me endurance and tolerance for myself and for her. And I heard in a meeting the other day, some guy with an old timer said, remember your sponsor's just a drunk. Right. And I have to remember that. And someone told me when I first got sober, your sponsor's not just your teacher, but you're her teacher as well. I was going to apologize because I know a lot of people in here. I was like, oh, you've heard my story before, but it's the only story I have. So I'm not going to apologize. Where I was like, shit, I can't really apologize for it. So anyway, when I was little, I grew up an army brat. First, my biological father, he was in the Navy, but he was abusive. We traveled quite a bit when I was little. And my mom divorced him when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And she, like, we could not communicate with him or his side of the family at all. And so my mom marries this other guy. He's in the Army. We travel a lot. And he was white. And back then, it wasn't cool to be a biracial couple. And so I got made fun of a lot. And I remember we lived in Hawaii, and I was about seven, eight years old, and I would walk way behind them in the mall because I was so embarrassed, you know, that he was white and she was black. And I was just, people would make fun of me all the time. I was always the new girl, the smallest girl, so I was really quiet. He was physically abusive. I remember when I was 8 years old, I told myself, I'm never, ever going to cry when he hits me again. And I have four kids, and when they were, you know, through their, this makes sense to mamas, but when your kids at certain ages, you remember and you reflect on it when you were that age. And I could not imagine having my 8 year old make that type of decision at 8 years old. You know, it's like, so I never really got to be a kid. He did teach me one thing though. He taught me how to be hypersensitive and to take the temperature of a room. Right. And he would always beat me for stuff my sister did. So I was always the new girl. I was quiet. I was always, it was really, 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 really uncomfortable and sometimes almost unbearable to be Lache Milo. And I like what you said, you know, like, how the fuck do you go to eighth grade? You know what I mean? Like, how do you show up for anything? And I was bulimic by the time I was seven because it, and, oh God, you know what? I'm going to take a deep breath because I know a lot of you. But I've never, I'm trying to remember a lot of my story because I blacked out for a lot of my story. And I'm so used to doing like 20 minutes feels, and I can just like get to the point 5 minutes and then sobriety, right? And so, but my experience is important, and it's important for me to remember. And so growing up with this abusive father, anyways, my mom would tell me stuff like, I love you, but I don't like you. And my vice principal, he said you would never amount to anything. And I believed like all of this stuff, like all my life up until I got sober and I learned the truth about who I am. And I was suicidal. Was always self-harming myself. I cried a lot. My mom would always say, you're super sensitive. Oh my God, stop it. Knock it off. You're so sensitive. Stop it off. Stop it. And when I first got sober, I was slinging snot all over the room. Like I cried so fucking much when I first got sober, like, oh my God. So, and you know, I'm thinking right now, like it must be necessary for me to remember all this stuff because I really do like talking about sobriety. Like this is hands down, if you are new, this is the best dope in town. Like this is better than anything I've ever dropped, drank, whatever. This is it. So my mom stayed with him until I was 15 years old. And I remember she said, we were about to go to Germany and I was excited. When you're an army brat and you're going to Germany, this is like really, really hella dope, right? And so right when he was getting transferred to Germany, she goes, I'm going to divorce him. The last straw was when he picked you up by your neck and threw you up against the wall. And I was like, bitch, I've endured more than that. Can't we like get to Germany first? Shit. Like, you know, let's get to Germany and then you can divorce him. So anyway, she leaves him, right? And so we move to Georgia. And that's when I started drinking when I was 15. And the first time I drank, we were playing, I lived in Georgia, so it's really redneck, so we drank Budweiser, and we were playing quarters. And I just remember playing quarters, and then my mom waking me up the next day and to clean up everything. And that's how I drank all my life. Like, from that point on, I drank to just blackout. Like, I never drank to be social, and I was proud of that. Like, I don't drink to be social. And anything I took, and I was thinking about this, too, as I'm reflecting on coming up on 10 years, I said, I had to have had at least one drink or like one hit of weed somewhere within this 10-year span. And it's like, Lache Milo, you have never had one of anything. Never, ever in my life. And it is a miracle. I'm going to read something in here and it talks about God commencing to do for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And that's exactly what happens. And like he said before, you don't have to do it perfectly, but if you just suit up and show up, and it's amazing. I know, you know, the thing is, so anyway, I was about to jump right into sobriety. I apologize. So anyway, so I grew up, my mom leaves him and, she kicks me out of the house because she had this boyfriend and he didn't like us. So she kicks me out at 16 and, fuck. And it was such a blur. Like I of course went to clubs and et cetera. And I was couch surfing. I was basically homeless. And I, at one point I got hooked on crack, and my mom had sent me to rehab, and I remember, her coming to get me, and I was in the back of this car, and I had this, remember the 7-Up bottles and the green 7-Up clear bottles, and I had poured some white wine in there, and we were supposed to be going to her house for dinner. And, so we get in the car, and I'm like, this doesn't look like her house. This isn't the way to my mom's house. And so we pull up, and my mom goes in, and my sister's in the car. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? And she's like, well, we're taking you to rehab. And I get out the car, and I'm trying to run, and my sister grabbed the back of my shirt like this. This is how retarded, oops, I wasn't supposed to say retarded, I'm so sorry. This is how stupid I was. I try to chew through my shirt. I'm just like gnawing through my shirt, trying to rip it and get away from her. And so anyway, I go to rehab, and I would call her every day, collect. And I was like, I fucking hate you! I hate you! And, but I think, thank God, and I thank her that she sent me, because I'm not hooked on crack, y'all. I still got all my teeth. And so, so thank you, Jesus. So, she, so I go to rehab, and then I don't even know what happened. Oh, I got married when I was 18. That's right. I started dancing. I started dancing when I was 18, and I was dancing on the Army base, and we were fully clothed. And this guy I met, and he was an officer. And 2 weeks after we met, he proposed, and we got married. And I thought, this is it. I am going to straighten up my life, and I'm going to go to school, and I'm not going to do drugs anymore. I'm not going to drink, and et cetera. And so we moved to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And he was at work, and I went to the mall, and I'm walking across the street, and this guy pulls up in the Mustang GT. This is like in 1988, right? So the Mustang GT, a white one, he pulls up, and he goes, do you want to go get high? I was like, yeah, okay. And I get in the car, and we get high, and from then it was a wrap. And this is how self-centered I was. This man, he was really good to me, bless his heart. He was 23, I was 18. And I went to Teen Challenge. I'm going to jump forward. I went to Teen Challenge when I was 20, and this counselor told me, she said, the devil doesn't come in a red suit or a pitchfork. He comes in tight jeans and a t-shirt. And this is exactly what happened. And so I get high with this guy. This guy ends up living like right around the corner from me. So I end up there like every day, and my ex-husband can't find me. So then I meet this girl, Portia, and she's like, we should go to Nashville and dance. I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. So I just leave. I was married for 11 months, and I left, and he did not know where I was. This man looked for me for 3 years, and I can't even really remember a lot of what happened in that time frame, because I was so fucked up. There was one point when I would get high, I was like, I can't talk to people without being high. There's just, like, no way that I can communicate to anyone, and I felt I was invincible. And here I am, y'all, I weighed like maybe 80 pounds, 5'2". And then I thought I was fat. That's the fucked up part. But anyway, so I thought I was invincible. I'd start fight with guys, you know, I was just big, you know? So I'm in Atlanta, and, we decide we're going to, I hate even sharing this at group level because some people are sicker than others, but we were going to strip across the United States is what we were going to do. And so, because I'm grown and I can do that. And so, so we decide we're going to do that. So we end up in Columbus, Georgia, which is my hometown. And there's this guy at the bar, and we meet and we start to date. And there's this church across the street. And this church would, chain up. Do I have time? I forgot to set my timer. Fuck, I got a shitload of time, y'all. Let me slow down. So they would chain up the parking lot, right? They would chain up the parking lot to keep the patrons from the strip club from going, you know, parking over there because whatever, for whatever reason, right? And so this guy, Mark Davis, we met, we were dating, and then come to find out his mom went to this church, right? And this is God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so, his mom went to the church, and he wanted to start this business. So his mom said, well, you know what? If you go to church with me, I'll give you money to start this business. So I had this little fuchsia mohawk back then. And by the way, this is not my hair, in case y'all are wondering. It's a weave. And so anyway, everybody keeps asking me. And so, because I have a mohawk underneath this. So anyway, I had this fuchsia mohawk, right? And so I go to this church and the pastor makes an altar call and I'm shaking in my seat. Now, mind you, it's probably because I was high, but I start shaking and I go up to the altar. I don't know why I'm shaking. He goes, "That's Jesus. That's Jesus." That's on me. He lays hands on me and I did get saved. And so what happened was his mom, she sponsored me to go to Teen Challenge. And I'm 20 years old at the time. And so I go to Teen Challenge, and that actually really did save my life. And so, and not because religion, I'm not, anyway, so whatever. So anyway, I go to Teen Challenge, and it's this rundown neighborhood, and there's this sunshine yellow, like, Victorian home, and it's just beautiful with white, you know, trimming and white porch, and I remember walking up the stairs, and I had this backpack on, and it was like the whole world was spinning around me, and God had just stopped that one moment in time just to let me off to get some rest. And before, backing up a little bit, when I would trip on acid a lot, I remember begging and praying. I said, "I just want peace of mind. I just want peace of mind. That's all I didn't want money. I didn't want a partner. I didn't want anything." And that continues to be my prayer throughout my life, is peace of mind. And so I remember just, I want peace of mind, and I got it. And so when I got to Teen Challenge, it was like God had just stopped the world, and that was it. So I did do it. I did it. I was on fire for Jesus, y'all. Like, I would go down the streets, path, and I'd be, "Jesus loves you!" And I carry this big fucking wooden cross through New Orleans, through the French Quarter. And I traveled Venezuela. I was a missionary in Venezuela. I was a missionary in Romania. And so... I was with this group called Youth with a Mission, YWAM, and I'm gonna back up a little bit. So all my life, I was terrified. I didn't like being a black woman, and I always thought like being white was like the answer to everything, right? And I was terrified of black men. And this is based after doing a fifth step. I have been healed from this, and I date black men. I'm, you know, whatever. But and I remember. So at Teen Challenge, so I had to tell that in order to tell this. So when I get to Teen Challenge, YWAM, we come from Romania, and for Christmas break, and all the teens from all over the world are meeting in this auditorium, right? And so I'm the only black girl, and there's no other black people, and then this one black guy comes in, and of course, everybody assumes that God has sent me my husband. And so everyone's like, "Oh, girl, that's your husband. God sent you your husband." I'm like, "What the fuck?" And I remember going in my room and bawling and crying and begging. I was like, "God, please, please, please don't make me do this, but if you do, Jesus, I'll do whatever you ask me to do. I was going to be a martyr for Jesus," right? So I go home for Christmas break, and I go out with my sister, my adopted sister, and I dance. When I dance by myself, and I close my eyes. And so she says, she comes up to me when I get to the table. She goes, "Girl, you pulled you a fine ass white boy." And I was like, "Where?" So he buys me a beer, and I am controlled drinking. And so he buys me a beer, and from that moment on, we were inseparable. And 4 days later, he proposed. Oh, my first husband did find me and divorce me. I just want you to know. And you know, I had the nerve to even ask him after he could not find me for 3 years. I'm like, "Can we like work it out?" You know? So he's like, "No, bitch, no." And so sign the papers. So I meet this guy. 4 days later, he proposes. A month later, we get married. Now, I do this, and after doing a fifth step, which is very, 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 it's vital, very, very important if you are to stay sober and have contented sobriety. After doing this fifth step, I understand why I did it. It was based out of fear, because he was, what, girl, he was blue eyes, just chiseled. He looked like a Greek god. And so, and that's why I did it. I did love him. Don't get me wrong. So anyway, we get married, and I'm going to, I don't usually share this at group level, but so anyway, we get married, and we get married so he can live off base and so he can collect BAQ. And so, but in my mind, because I'm delusional, right? I'm going to have sex with him, and I'm going to cook and clean and make this motherfucker stay married to me forever, right? Because I'm living in this fantasy, right? And so he does decide to stay with me forever, and we moved to Carpinteria, California. And so we moved to Carpinteria, California. How much time do I have?
you're there.
Okay.
I'll
let you know if you're okay. Fine. I'm gonna get sober. I want to get sober really fast. So anyway, so it's fucking drunk a log. And so, anyway, so he, we get married, move to Carpinteria, and 3 years into the marriage, I get pregnant at 26. I'm 23 at the time. I get pregnant, and I find out I'm pregnant, and I'm really excited because he's cute, and I'm black, and our kids are going to be super cute. And so we get married. I get pregnant, and I was pregnant for 4 years straight. Like, I have, like, it was just never, there was, on the fourth one, someone came up and go, oh my God, are you still pregnant? I was like, do not fucking talk to me. So I have, we have four kids, and okay, back up a little bit. So when we go to the courthouse to get married, he tells me, do not get this twisted. This is not for real. Right? And I was just like, oh yeah, sure, whatever. Right? And so, now he told me who he was. And when people tell you or show you who they are, you believe them. Believe them, right? And the part of the delusion was I was trying to make him something he wasn't. And I was trying to create this family. Like, if I have four kids, we're a family, goddammit. And of course he's going to stay together with me, right? But needless to say, 9 years into the marriage, he goes to Iraq. Before he goes to Iraq, I find out that he cheats on me with one of my friends. And I was not okay with it, but I was like, you know, maybe we can work this out. So he goes to Iraq, 15 months, he comes back. But before he comes back, he decides that he wants to tell me, confess, and come clean and say, I want to start with a clean slate. But I've been cheating on you for the past five years with over 22 women. Girl, I know. I was like, this shit ain't gonna work for me. I'm sorry. So, and I did the math, you know, my little Talise, my fourth one, like, wasn't even, like, she was just born, right, before he went to Iraq. So I'm doing the math, like, this motherfucker, this is when I was pregnant with Kaden, and then, you know, all these girls started coming out of the woodwork, you know, and so, and I did, I tried to make it work. Because I'm still delusional, right? And I want this to work because there's something that I'm afraid of that I can't quite identify yet that keeps me moving into unsafe spaces, right? Because I'm trying to protect myself. And so, and that's what I love about sobriety. You know what I mean? Like, I get to walk through fear and I have a protector. You know what I mean? I get to walk with my head up high, like walk through anything and take on challenges that I never, ever, ever thought I could do before. And so, so we get divorced, needless to say. So I divorce him and, then I really spiraled. When he was in Iraq, I really spiraled, drinking Coke, I'd wake up out of blackouts, doing things that, like, as a mother of four in Carpinteria, you just don't do. And so, he comes back and we decide that we're going to like go spend some time together, without the kids. And let's see if we're going to work this out. We're in the hotel room and his phone rings and y'all know this is when we had flip phones back then. So he flips it open and he closes it. I was like, that was a girl, wasn't it? And he said, yeah. I was like, nah, I'm done. Like, I can't do it. But I knew in that moment, like, even before when I found out he was cheating, that something was going to change. And this is something my sponsor always, she would say, you're going to evolve with or without your permission. So it's just which way you want to evolve, right? So I knew that there was work to be done whether I stayed with him or whether I left him. But I chose not to stay with him, right? So anyway, I decide again that I'm going to go to school and this is going to fix it. So I'm going to go and I'm going to go to college and this is going to fix it. And, I can't stop drinking. I can't stop smoking weed. So I did go to jail twice, for hitting him and, stayed in jail for 8 days each total. And so, so while I'm clearing up my record and going to court and et cetera, I decided I'm going to go to school and I'm drinking before class and I take these three classes and I know one of them is a creative writing class and one of them is a black history. I can't remember what the other class was. And I write this story while I'm high and I thought it was fucking awesome, but my teacher didn't think it was awesome. And so I quit the class. I was like, fuck this shit. And so I stayed in the black history class, right? And part, shit, damn it. There's just so much I want to share with you. So anyway, so then I take this Black History class. So then there's this girl in this class. Her name is Naima. And she told me her name, and she's a Black girl. Now, mind you, I'm in Santa Barbara, and there's very few Black people in Santa Barbara. But I took a Black History class to educate myself about Black people. So then, in turn, I can educate my four biracial African children about Black people. Because my three older ones, like my oldest, she said, I don't like Black people. And I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm Black, you know, so, and then my second daughter, wouldn't sit out in the sun. She's kind of fair skinned and she wouldn't sit out the sun so she couldn't get dark. And I remember in a preschool, you know, they make those outlines of their bodies and they have to color their bodies in. Well, she wouldn't color her body and she'd leave it white. And then my son wouldn't kiss me for, I don't know how long it was, but he wouldn't kiss me. He goes, I don't want to kiss you. You Black. And so, yeah, so. They didn't know, you know, mind you, it's Santa Barbara. And so that's why I take this Black history class. And so I meet this Black girl in my class, and she kept giving me her number and said, you didn't call me. I'm like, what is your name again? Naomi? And she's Naima. So finally I call her, and she has these two little girls, and then we end up being like Ace, Boom, Coons. We were inseparable. We were rolling deep, us and six kids everywhere. We went everywhere. But she was in AA. And we would go out at night. And she goes, oh, I have to go to this meeting. This Heffa. And she said, I have to go to this meeting first. And then we'll go out. And so, I'm about to get sober, y'all. Oh, I'm excited. Here we go. Now we got the bullshit out the way. So anyway, so we go to this meeting and people will come up and ask me, are you an alcoholic? I was like, no, I smoke weed. No, I'm not an alcoholic, but even though I was. And so, and then we go dancing. And then I remember I would say hi and I would apologize to her. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so fucked up. I am so sorry. And she's like, girl, enjoy it. Don't, you know, don't trip. So we keep going to these meetings. And then one day, I went to Brophy Brothers in Santa Barbara and I said to myself when I was going in, I said, you know what? I'm only going to have one glass of wine. Now, if you're not an alcoholic, you don't have to tell yourself you're going to have one glass of wine. And so, but I knew the bartender, and then we're with this group of people. And then I, wake up out of a blackout, and this girl, her brother was there visiting from out of town. And I was 35 at the time, and he told me he was 18. And so I wake up out of blackout, and we were on the beach, and then we come back up. And she says, you know, he's only 17. I was like, fuck. So then I call Naima the next day. I was like, I think I kind of need a meeting. And so I go to Off Center on a Sunday morning. And I remember raising my hand. My name is Lache and I'm an alcoholic. And from that moment on, and it's like, they talk about going to any lengths, right? And so just like I drank and I used drugs, that's how I fucking got sober, right? I cannot remember every fucking detail. All I know is my sponsor kept me fucking busy. Anytime she said jump, I jumped. She said, I didn't have a fucking car. She goes, go pick up this newcomer. I don't know how I did it. But I was exactly where she said, have your fourth step done in 2 weeks. That shit was done in a week. You know, she said, call her every day. I called her every day. I called her so many times a day, all day. I was at her work. I was up under her and on her like white on rice because she had something that I wanted. And I have sponsees, right? And this is what trips me out. So I get a sponsee and they're a little high maintenance. And they want to go, well, you just don't have time. And you just, you know, whatever. Bitch, first of all, I got a life, right? And my world does not revolve around you. But two, I don't want what you got. You need to call me. You know what I mean? You want what I have. So, and I'm just a drunk. And so anyway, so my sponsor, she would tell me things like, and you know, you hear all the slogans like, keep coming back and we'll love you till you can love yourself. She would say stuff like, you will evolve with or without your permission. Everything is necessary. All kinds of other stuff. And I can't, they'll come out as I go along. But anyway, I don't have my glasses, but I'm going to ask someone, I think, to read for me. If I can do that. And Michelle. So right here.
We are
to the tremendous fact to the end of there.
Okay. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship. a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, where camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out which we can absolutely agree with, on which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism.
Thank you. One thing she would have us do is we would have to underline the word fact. And what that meant was I don't have to prove it. You know what I mean? I don't have to do any more research. If it's a fact, it's a fact. And it says the tremendous fact is that this shit works. There's nothing I can add to it. There's nothing I can take away from it. All I have to do is follow direction and follow what's in black and white. It's all out. I don't have to create anything. Right? And it works. It actually, 10 years later, like after doing all of this stuff, like I can sit back and like, and the amazing thing, now suicide does cross my mind sometimes, but like drinking does not really cross my mind. You know what I mean? Like to go to a drink, right? I always want to, it's either all or nothing. It's like I either live or I'm fucking dead. I can't, there's no middle ground. And what I love about this program is that I don't have to do it by myself and that there are people that have come before me and after me. And when I was talking before about everything being necessary, and so the things that I have gone through, and that's our experience, strength, and hope, we don't know who we are going to touch, come across, where our story will actually help them. And I remember when I was 20, this is when I'm not going to make sense, but I promise it comes together. So when I was 20 years old, my mom was 40, and I looked at my mom and I said, I don't know, how did you live to be 40 years old? Like I could not fat, like literally I was done. That was it, right? That hopelessness. And so there are several women, and it doesn't matter whether or not I sponsor them, right? It doesn't matter. It says strenuous work with another alcoholic is vital for permanent sobriety. Strenuous work isn't just me and my sponsor. Strenuous work is sitting your ass still in a meeting and paying attention, doing commitments, showing up, talking to another alcoholic after a meeting, anything that has to do where I interact with another alcoholic, that is strenuous work. And strenuous means great effort and energy. And one thing she said too, do not try to fit AA into your life. You fit your life into AA. And pinky promise, it always works out. If I put my sobriety first, and you think that's something that they just come, oh my God, you know, anything you put before your sobriety, you lose. Like it's the truth. Like, it's the truth. This is the only... Now I have this... Y'all, I'm so hot. I got myself worked up. We have to have fans in here. And this is a black church. Where are the fans at? Shit. So, anyway, I'm going to read something else. This is my favorite. Actually, the other Michelle. Can you read, There Is a Solution?
There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed.
Oh, thank you. That's it. So, and I'm going to, I think I'm almost done, right? Okay, so this is my favorite story, and this is what I'm going to kind of end with, and this kind of goes with this. So my favorite analogy of sobriety is, so I have sponsees, and one of them had texted me. She said, how do I get a spiritual awakening, right? And a couple of things. One, so in step 11 it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. to improve. So there's always contact. There's something, whether I acknowledge it, whether I can see it, touch it, feel it, there's always something that's connected to my higher power. I don't make my heart beat. I don't, you know, cause my lungs to expand. There's always something. So every moment, and this is to improve my consciousness, which is my awareness that I'm always connected to something greater than myself, right? That's the point. That's the fucking fourth dimension. And we've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. Like, this is where I reside. This is where the truth of who La Che Milo is in the fourth dimension. And I have to, because it said that it is vital for permanent sobriety. I have to do the work here. For me, if you're an alcoholic, this isn't for everyone. AA does not have the monopoly, but for if you're an alcoholic like Bill is or whoever it describes in this book, all the people that describes it, then this is vital. We are not too smart. We are not too cute. We are not too rich. We are not too uneducated to do this shit. And it can be simple. You will evolve with or without your permission. Either way, you get to choose where you want to put the work in. That's it. So anyway, so my favorite story. So I have four kids, right? And when I was 26, well, I was 25 going on 26, I found out that I was pregnant with my first baby and I was super stoked. I thought that was it. I always wanted to be a mama. So I find out I'm pregnant and we're excited about it. And then like the first month, like I start throwing up a lot. Like I was like 93 pounds when I started. Like by the time my first trimester was over, I was down to like 80 pounds again. And I was throwing up and it was really uncomfortable. Like, what the fuck is this? Like, I want to have, you know, So then, but I go to the doctor, right? And I'd look at the chart and I'd see, oh my God, at like 2 months, this is how big the baby is. And she'd do that thing on the, and I'd hear the heart and I'd get all stoked and excited again. Oh my God, is this baby, right? And so then, but then like I started getting hot flashes, right? And then I got the flu and it was really fucking uncomfortable, right? So then about 6 months in, right, my hips start separating. My sciatica fucks up so bad. I have to go to an acupuncturist. Super uncomfortable, right? So, but then at one point in this whole time, within the 6 months, did I go in and go, okay, God, you know what I think would be a really good idea though? If we did like the brain first and then we develop the heart, right? And then I want her to have super curly hair and then brown eyes and et cetera, right? I didn't get to do that, right? So I just had to like show up and deal with this. In the midst of all of that discomfort, I had nothing to do. All I had to do was have sex with my ex-husband. That's it. And say, yes, I'm going to carry this baby full term. That's it. Something miraculous and amazing is transpiring within my stomach, right? Right. And this is just like sobriety, where my girls are like, oh my God, it's like everybody wants to write and do. And writing is good. I'm not saying, but sometimes you just got to sit in some shit. Right? And that's just how we grow. You just got to work through it. So 6 months, 7 months, 7 months, I'm just like, I'm through. And then I would say to myself, okay, by this time next year, I would have a baby. By this time, but mind you, I was pregnant 4 years straight, so my ass was pregnant again. And so May 1st, 1996, first we went to Lamaze class, right? We went to Lamaze class and we do the breathing techniques of shh, 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 shh. Then we learn about the ring of fire. And the ring of fire is when you are 10 centimeters dilated. And that's when the head crowns. And they say the ring of fire can last for an hour and a half to 2 hours. Also, if you want an epidural, you have to do it before you're 2 centimeters dilated, right? After 2 centimeters, that's it. You can't. So May 1st, which is around my due date, I'm sitting on the couch and I'm knitting, 1996, and I have this pain. Right. And mind you, I've had Braxton Hicks, the practice ones. Right. So I call up my midwife and I said, I'm sure it's nothing, but I think I'm in labor. And she's like, oh, OK, when they're 5 minutes apart, come into the hospital. Now, mind you, and this is how I do with anything in my life. La, 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 la. I'm going to pretend it's not happening. Right. Because then I won't have to go through it. So then my ex-husband comes home around. This is at 9:30 in the morning. Right. My ex-husband comes home around 3:30 after work. It's not a big deal, but I think I might be in labor. Like, they're just 15 minutes apart, but just no big deal, right? So as we're going along, you know, the contractions are getting stronger. Then all of a sudden, I start, like, throwing everything up. I start depleting every liquid and solid out of my body, right? I'm heaving, I'm on all fours, you know, heaving, I'm excruciating pain, right? So 5 minutes apart, he takes me to the emergency room. We get to the emergency room and I sit in the wheelchair and then all of a sudden, like, the reality hit, like, this shit is going down, like, with or without my permission, I'm about to fucking evolve. And I start shaking and my teeth start chattering and I was like, you know what, maybe I can come back and I can have an I can have a C-section or, like, we can stop it or something. She's like, oh, and they just wheel me in, right? They wheel me in. Get inside, contractions, past 2 centimeters dilated, but I said I was going to do this without an epidural, right? I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. And so we get on the table. We do the jacuzzi. They had a jacuzzi where I can sit in the jacuzzi where it alleviates a lot of the pressure. But then when it was time to push, right? So I'm up on the table and I'm pushing. The first few times it hurts, right? But then the ring of fire hits, right? And I'm 10 centimeters dilated. Now, sorry, bless you. So 10 centimeters, I'm dilated. I can't have an epidural at this time, right? So I start freaking out. It is, they say that at that point, it's like fracturing 20 bones all at the same time. Now I'm doing this without any drugs, anything. I flip out. I'm screaming at the only time I scream. I was just like, get this the fuck out of me. Just screaming and hollering. And I felt every sensation in my body. I can't even, if you've had a baby, or if you fractured 20 bones at the same time, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So anyway, so then my midwife goes, Lache. And so I look at her and she says, you have got to focus and breathe or you're going to hurt yourself or the baby. Okay. She said, breathe. I breathe. She said, push. I push. It didn't take away the pain, right? But it helped me through the pain. 2 pushes, it was over. It wasn't even an hour and a half. Thank you, God. That's all I could think about, that there is no way this shit is going to last a whole hour and a half, 2 hours. I push out the baby. They put her up here, and she nurses. But first, my first one came out in the embryonic sac, so my water never broke. And they did like this, and it rolled, and all the water came out. And then she cried, just this little cry. She had these beautiful, like, long lashes, embedded her lashes. And they put her up, and she nurses. And I was like, oh, my God, that was not so bad. I can do that again. But I was so high, right? Remember at the beginning I said, this is the best dope in town? I get high off that shit now after sitting through some shit. Right? And dealing with some shit, you know what I mean? And like watching God do for me, I'm outside my body sometimes, watching God do for me what I couldn't do for myself, like stand up. I never had a voice. Never. This would not be happening. When I was in school, do I have time?
You're right there.
Oh, well, that's it. Yeah, is that it? Okay, so when I was in school, like people, like I would literally like have my head down all the time and I just couldn't talk. You know what I mean? And this guy, when I was in my 20s, you know, he saw me and I knew him in Oklahoma when we lived in Oklahoma and I was little. He says, I could never understand a word you were saying, right? I could never, like, you always, like, would say something and just and have your head down. But that's not me today, right? And I am this little woman in this big fucking body and fuck my principal and my mama. Like, I am, like, changing lives, right? I have amounted to something, right? And that is Lache Milo, and she is fucking amazing. That's it.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.